I was always trying to figure out my identity because we're talking about Colorado, Maryland, Michigan, Texas, Virginia. Those are very different cultures from one another. But all of those experiences together helped me realize I was always searching for what is my identity. And over time, getting comfortable with who I am, the energetic side of me that some people look at and go, oh, that's just too much, which in the past I might have tamped down. That's an example of finding my identity and going, you know what? I see the flaws in it, but I love it because it's who I am.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to another episode of Trial Lawyer View. I'm excited to have as my guest today, Charlie Mann, the visionary behind Law Firm Alchemy. With over 14 years of experience in the legal coaching consulting world, Charlie has dedicated himself to transforming the way law firms operate and grow. Through Law Firm Alchemy, Charlie provides tailored coaching and resources that help law firm owners break through growth barriers and achieve remarkable success. As the host of They Don't Teach This in Law School, Charlie shares his valuable insights on law firm management and entrepreneurial strategies, offering practical advice and guidance for attorneys aiming to elevate their practices. Charlie's approach emphasizes the importance of integrating strong business acumen with legal expertise, focusing on marketing, leadership, and client relationship management. Known for his approachable demeanor and deep industry knowledge, Charlie is committed to helping law firms thrive by fostering genuine connections and maintaining high standards of integrity and transparency. In this episode, we dive into Charlie's strategies for law firm growth, explore effective marketing techniques, and discuss how attorneys can balance personal and professional development to build a thriving legal practice. Hey, Charlie, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to the Trial Lawyer Review podcast.
Jason, excited to be here, excited to talk with you, join the ranks of guests like Craig Goldenfarb, Mike Mogul, so many trial lawyers, et cetera, to be part of this show.
We have had some great guests, but I'm really excited to chat with you today. I wanted to ask you first, because I follow you a bit on social media, and I know that you are preparing to run a marathon next month, I think at least. I wanted to ask you how training is going, and has it taught you anything related to law firm growth or your business?
Running is one of the great metaphors. I would say that if we're talking great metaphors, it starts with like fishing, right? Everyone can come up with a fishing metaphor somehow. Then you have, for me at least, football. You can interchange baseball in there, but you know, one of the major U.S. sports. And then you have running, right? That's another great universal theme. So right now, I'm a little sidetracked, if we're being honest, because I ended up with something called cuboid syndrome, which there's this bone in the foot. It kind of gets rolled, right? Like, it sounds like a science fiction disease a little bit. But the good news is I'm probably like 2 or 3 days away from being able to run on it. I have a couple of 17-mile training runs under my belt at this point. I'm sort of in the arena of, as long as my cardio doesn't fade significantly because I don't have the opportunity to put in that work, I should be fine. I know it seems insane to say it's only 26 miles, but I don't know. Like, if we're going metaphor-wise, it's one foot in front of the other, and have you put in the work to get there? And then I think the ultimate metaphor, Jason, is probably, if we say life is a marathon rather than a sprint, it's about pacing yourself and not running so hard at the beginning that you end up burning yourself out, which, you know, a lot of law firm owners end up doing as well when they start a new marketing program, a new system in their firm. They go really hot right at the beginning, burn out, and fade away as the rest of the crowd slowly marches past them. So now we have our good marathon metaphor for it.
Perfect. Yeah.
Have you ever run a marathon?
No, but I'm a cyclist, and so I've done a bunch of centuries, 100-mile rides, and it's the same thing, right? I mean, I don't know, because I've never run a marathon, but a century ride is pretty grueling, especially here in Florida, where I'm from. You know, there's a lot of flat roads, so we can have very fast centuries. I think the fastest one I did, we averaged over 22 miles an hour.
I was going to ask how fast you go. That's insane.
That was brutal, but I was racing at the time and very competitive. And so it was hard, but it was within, you know, the scope of reason. Like, my thought around running a marathon is, I just don't think my body would allow me to do it, but that's just my body type, I think.
Yeah. You know, and for a long time, honestly, I'm primarily, I would call myself maybe like a strength or power athlete if I had to categorize myself, which is to say, I'm not really an athlete by any stretch of the imagination, but those are where my strengths lie. So this running thing has been new, and it's why I prefer the distance over the sprint, because the sprint will kill me. But I think that the longer the race gets, because it becomes a lot more of a mental game as well, the more I can kind of stand out in that category. Now, over time, I would love to hit a couple of benchmarks on the marathon, but, you know, it's actually funny, Jason. I'm in the midst with this cuboid syndrome. I've been biking a lot because just the type of pressure on the foot is totally different. And I'm glad you mentioned the 22 miles per hour, because, like, I'm going up to 13 and a half miles per hour with some hills around me and everything, and it's cooking me, Jason. It's absolutely cooking me. Totally brutal. So hats off to you on those century rides.
Yeah, people think that, oh, it doesn't sound like that hard, but, like, you know, maintaining that kind of pace, especially, you know, for that kind of time period. Like, when I ride today, and I'm not competitive anymore, I ride maybe at 16 miles an hour, but that's a good solid zone in your heart rate zone workout, which is perfect for someone, you know, my age at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy biking, but I'm still getting used to that. Like, it is a very different stimulus compared to running. And it is interesting to go through that process of learning, taking this kind of skill set, this physical skill set, and applying it to something new, where you would think, like, oh, it's a physical skill set. It uses my legs. I should be able to kind of jump in and go and do relatively well at it. And to feel myself needing to build up, like, I'll do 45 minutes and cover maybe 10 miles. And, like, I've run 17 miles, yet 45 minutes and 10 miles on a bike hits me just as hard as those big long training runs, because I'm adapting to a new stimulus, which, I mean, you know, talk about another incoming metaphor right there. I think that for a lot of law firm owners, you know, you build up this rigorous intellectual tool set over time, and then you go to apply it to a business, and it seems like it could be a one-to-one translation. And then you find out, oh, nope, totally new set of stimuli here that you have to adapt yourself to. And you can't take that for granted. You have to put in the work. Like, it's going to take time for me to get good on a bike. And I'd like to, because I'd like to do a triathlon at some point. But if you're not willing to just sort of soak in that and spend your hours, spend your days getting good at a physical skill or a mental skill, you know, you're never going to last. You're not going to outlast your competitors, for sure. Because they'll do it. They'll put in that work. Someone is going to. In your market, someone is going to put in that work for a long enough amount of time that it will place them at the top. And maybe they're only going to increase 5% every single year. But hey, you could increase 50% this year, then completely burn out on it and never see any more gain. It might take them some time, but they're going to march past you.
Great metaphor, because that idea of your comfort zone, and being a lawyer and actually have my own small law practice, I know, you know, coming out of law school, I had no foundation in business whatsoever. I was a psych major undergrad from law school. So, you know, that didn't help me when it came to starting synergy in my business. And I learned everything by hard knocks, unfortunately. But, you know, the opportunity to work with someone like you, I think, helps lawyers ultimately get into a comfort zone when it comes to running a law firm like a business. And your company, Law Firm Alchemy, specializes in helping law firms break through these growth plateaus. What are five common obstacles that personal injury law firms face when trying to scale their practice, and how can they overcome these challenges?
Yeah, the first obstacle is definitely the core marketing obstacle, which is accepting that marketing is a primary and that you can't really escape that, right? We'd all love, and I'm honest about this, I would love if we lived in a world where it was just do good work and the cases will come, right? That would be phenomenal. But we know for sure that's just not the case. So you need to be an active participant in your marketing. That would be the first thing that we have to break through. And then related to that, but I'll make it the second item, because it's so important, I put a focus on it, especially with six-figure firm owners who are trying to scale up and want to do so usually fairly fast and with a really solid return on their time and money invested in it. You need to break free of the similar trap with referral marketing as well, which is, okay, if I break through that first one, I say, I can't just do good work and the cases will come. Then you'll say, okay, I'm willing to do some of this digital marketing, right? I'll do some of this pay-per-click. I'll try local service ads. I'll work my Google business profile. But you're probably still going to maintain that mindset regarding referrals. But referrals are still an outbound marketing process when you really want to scale up, right? You need to send letters. You need to have lunches. You need to do handwritten cards. You need to publish online. You need to build a list that you nurture. And that way, you can actually scale your referrals rather, again, just crossing your fingers. Number three that we're usually working on is, do you have any metrics that you're using? Like metrics that guide your decision-making as well. So I like to install three core metrics into a law firm. Usually it's going to be new cases acquired, files that we've closed out, files or matters that we've closed out this month. And we go month by month monitoring these metrics. And that gives us a quick sense of in and out production on the firm. And then I like to have a production metric in the middle there that says, when we get a case, we move it along, we move it through our pipeline. So that way I can see, okay, case gets acquired. We know that we have an active operations department and we're closing out matters that is financially beneficial to us. Because even if you're a firm that does fixed fee work up front, you know, you're an estate planner or you're a family law mediator and you have that, you just charge the big upfront fee. When you acquire that, at some point you do have to conclude that matter. Otherwise, it's just endless, quiet, silent. You don't really see it cash burn that you're putting into the production of that case. So you do need to conclude that matter. So we're looking at those three core metrics. So that gives us our first three. The next is, are we starting to establish what the owner should be doing and shouldn't be doing? Okay. So are you the owner starting to think about yourself as the entrepreneur? And are you starting to think about replacing what you do within the firm? Starting with the low, you know, minimal tasks. A great book on this is Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell. Yeah. That has, yeah, right? Yeah, you're immediately nodding at that, Jason. Is that a book that you've dug into as well?
Yeah, and actually I'm part of a CEO kind of business group that he's a part of. So I'm very familiar with his work.
Send him my regards, him and, you know, like 25 people that I work with via mastermind and coaching. We all owe him healthy regards. I use his email GPS system for myself, recommend it to every single person I work with as well. And that whole idea of, can I buy back my time? And really the way that he puts it so well is, you're not necessarily buying to add on to what you're doing. You're buying to replace what you're currently doing. It's to take away from yourself to allow you to level up, which means over time, and this is always the hardest one, I'm sure you've seen it with firm owners as well, Jason, is the, can I replace myself as an attorney? That's the big one. When you finally get to that point and you can have, you know, two, three attorneys working for you, that's when we're going to hit that real escape velocity for you. But then that comes to the final point, which is it kind of dovetails off of this fourth point here, which is truly the identity. Can you see yourself as an entrepreneur first and then put lawyer lower down on the list? And like for someone like you, you know, you've built multiple businesses. And so you know what it feels like to be a CEO, you know, over in Synergy, you know, operating as the CEO. And so for someone like you, you can grasp that idea much faster for your law firm because you've experienced it in another place, right? You've gained all these incredible practice reps. And there's probably something that you already studied, a mindset that you already had coming into it that even allowed you to launch a company like Synergy. But for a lot of law firm owners, right, you've seen it. It's, I have such a hard time decoupling my identity from being a great lawyer. And so that fifth thing is super powerful on the mindset front. And then the first thing, that's, you know, the really pragmatic side of marketing.
I want to double click on that. But first, I wanted to go back to something that you said, because it's something that we see quite often is law firms failing to look at their metrics and understanding how to operate at peak efficiency and profitability. You know, because part of what we do is we'll go in and show them, here's how many dollars you could save by simply outsourcing lien resolution and taking off your attorneys and your paralegals the obligations and requirements of doing all the things that need to be done in order to resolve those liens, which ultimately is what holds up finally dispersing to the client. So, and it goes along with some of the metrics you talked about. So just wanted to mention that because I think it's important. There's just less of a focus on metrics, I think, generally in the way law firms are run. There are exceptions. You mentioned Craig Oldenfarb, who's been on here, Mike Morse, Rob Levine, who his episode is going to probably come out before this one. They all operate very much metric driven and they have big operations, but a lot of law firms just simply don't operate in that sphere today.
I remember talking with one of your team members at Craig's Seven Figure Attorney Summit and him explaining this process and, you know, taking over that lien resolution thing. I was like, oh my gosh, this is a slam dunk for so many PI firms that I know. And you see that reflected as well in a position that I've seen popping up in a couple of PI firms, which is they're looking for closing specialists. Like they want someone whose job it is to handle the last 10% of the case, you know, getting it over the finish line. Because it doesn't do you any good to have a bunch of 90% complete inventory when all of your money is waiting on the other side. Now, Jason, I'm curious about your reaction to this concept I'm going to toss out there, which is, sometimes I feel like for PI attorneys, tell me what you think about this. There's this feeling of if I start resolving cases really fast, then I'm not going to be able to imagine how big this bolus of money is ahead of me. And it makes me feel like my firm is worth less when the money comes in and I don't see as much money out ahead of me because I'm speeding up the process. I feel like that's something that I've encountered mindset-wise. What do you think about that?
Well, that can be a vicious circle because, I mean, obviously you've got to always be looking at the velocity of files coming in the door and what's going out. We do that, right? Because we're looking at file counts. And I mean, we have the identical situation really, because if we are too fast in eating up inventory that we have, in theory, that could be problematic, but we don't look at it that way because ultimately, what we have to deliver for our client is the most efficient and best result. And I think for law firms, it's the identical thing. I mean, ultimately, you've got to keep an eye on all of that. But too, I mean, just because you resolve something quickly doesn't really impact the other side of it, which is marketing and how fast you're bringing in new matters. How efficient are you at bringing those in? So I think once you have a handle on all of that, should be better, you know, demonstrated by your dashboards.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, one of the things I work on with a lot of the PI firm owners is starting to do some type of projection of revenue. Usually we ease them into it by going by quarter for the next 12 to 18 months and say, all right, take your cases. You know, you've been at this long enough. What do you think is going to resolve within the first quarter of 2025, for example? What do you think the overall value of that will be to your firm? Okay, now we're going to do the same thing for quarter two, three, four. And then depending on what state you're in, and usually, you know, we try and focus first and foremost on pre-litigation matters because that's where they tend to feel most confident and obviously largest percentage in that space. But we do want to stretch ourselves into litigation matters because there are going to be litigation matters from farther in the past that are coming to resolution in the first quarter of this next year and getting them confident with that. And the first hurdle to overcome there, I find, is they're going to be wrong at times, and it makes them nervous. But you can't be right unless you start and start observing it and figure out why, where are you getting your projections wrong? Do you tend to underestimate, project too soon of a resolution, too late of a resolution? You know, it doesn't do you any good unless you actually start monitoring it though, right?
Well, and it's exactly what we do. I mean, I think most businesses try to do this is project out revenue based on, you know, what you know is in the factory, right? I mean, we track all of that. We track the different lien types and how long it takes to resolve those so that we can more accurately predict out the front windshield instead of always looking out the rear, because that the rear, you don't see the headlights coming at you. If you don't have eyes forward, it's a scary thing as a business owner, whether you're a personal injury law firm or your company like ours or your company. I mean, everybody needs to have eyes out that front windshield.
Yeah. And having predictive metrics is really powerful. I'm curious, like for your firm or for Synergy, when you're handling predictive measurements, do you look at, you know, new leads generated? Do you look even farther ahead at like, hey, here's our traffic that we're starting to get? Where do you really hone in on those predictive metrics?
We look at intake, open, you know, because they don't, not every referral actually turns into what we call an open. And then we track it through the factory. I mean, I think we're very much like a law firm in that regard. I think the way we do it, really a firm could look at things that way. And then we look at what are our average fees based on these different services that we're offering. And then we project out based on that. And, you know, based on the velocity of intake, we know a certain percentage pulls to open. And then we know, you know, then approximately how long it takes to move through the factory. And then ultimately what on average the fees are.
How long did it take you to get those numbers fairly well dialed in?
I mean, it's taken us, you know, a while of honing our dashboards and continuing to work on different calculations to bring us to a metric that we felt comfortable with. I wouldn't say it's instantaneous. And two, you know, the more data we feed in, the more accurate it seems to be in terms of where we're going to land from a revenue perspective.
Yeah, because that's always something that concerns firm owners I work with is this, how long do they have to stick with it? Can they be consistent with it? I think the best thing for consistency on that is oftentimes making it someone else's problem on the team to get that data for you and just make that their responsibility. Because I don't know about you, Jason, but I love looking at the numbers. I hate assembling the numbers.
Same. I mean, we have people that are dedicated to building all of our Power BI dashboards, you know. So, you know, we have people that are dedicated to doing all of that. And I think as a law firm owner, you have to commit to it and know that it takes some time to develop the data and see what information it gives you. But there's so much power in it once it's there and you can start to digest it and understand what moves you have to make as a business owner in order to do the things that are necessary to be efficient and profitable. So I wanted to ask you about entrepreneurial skills because, as I mentioned, they don't teach you anything about that in law school. So how do law firm owners cultivate the skills if they haven't been formally trained in business management to develop those successfully and run and grow a law firm? That's, you know, may seem to the average personal injury attorney who's running a law firm almost insurmountable.
I'm sympathetic to that. So I came from the artist community at first. I was a theater major in college, Jason. So like I look at it from that world of people who are really antagonistic towards capitalism, to say the least. And, you know, it's one of the reasons that I didn't entirely fit in with that space. But learning to work on those, I think of it the same way that like my 7-year-old, who she has a lot of physical talents and we're really pouring into soccer in particular for her because she's fast. She's this dense little muscle hamster of a child and she can like barrel through other kids. But really to make her feel like right now for her, the way that she kind of plays the game, it's like soccer is a solo sport, right? It might as well be swimming or golf. And obviously it's a team sport. So one of the things that we're doing is, how do we get in practice reps that teach her what it's like to operate as a team member in soccer rather than a soloist in soccer? And that's the same thing that I look at with law firm owners is, how do we get practice reps in on entrepreneurial skills? And this is actually where I love marketing so much, because it's one of the places that you can just leap in and take practice reps without any permission, right? Leadership is something you need to have members of your team to start practicing leadership. And it's a little bit harder to do as consistently, even though you should be doing it and having tough conversations and being bold and, you know, rallying the troops. But marketing can be as simple as send the email, post on LinkedIn, shoot a video. And that's something you can do every single day. And to help you feel like an entrepreneur, let's do one entrepreneur thing every day. Because like with my kiddo, we have what we call our hundreds right now. And so one of the hundreds is she's going to shoot 100 shots. There's going to be 5 on each foot, and we're going to back her up 10 times. So that way she can really feel what it's like to shoot from distance, get good with that. But for the team element, there's 100 passes as well. 100 passes off of her foot. So we do our hundreds with her, you know, 3-4 times a week. And then we also have a soccer team that she plays on as well, like an academy style team. Same idea. Can you get your hundreds in? Can you get in your, I'm going to go and kick the ball. No one's giving me permission to do this. I'm just going to show up at the local field. I'm going to show up. That's right there, that phrase. I'm going to show up with my marketing. That's, if a law firm owner can conquer that issue right there, they're going to start to embrace that entrepreneurial side very fast because they see the results of it. And that, as soon as we can get them a win, right, Jason? As soon as we can get them a win, they're like, okay, this might actually be fun. I might enjoy this part of it. And now we're shifting their identity. Now they're feeling more and more like an entrepreneur. For yourself, was it early on that you felt yourself being an entrepreneur, or was it something that you the spark happened and then a fire was lit for you?
Well, my parents were entrepreneurs. I mean, you know, when I went to law school, I didn't anticipate the path that I am now on. So it wasn't a thought back then, but as soon as I began practicing law, I realized that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. I liked doing the litigation, but you know, I really wanted to do something different. So I got into settlement services world and worked with another company for about 10 years, became president of that company, and then said, you know what? I want to do this for myself. I like a different model. I want to build something on my own. And that's ultimately what I did, which I do think, you know, to a large extent was fueled by just, you know, my family's dynamics of that entrepreneurial spirit and seeing what they built, even though I know it was extremely hard. And it has been the same for this, you know, it's never easy to do this because you ultimately are going to learn some hard lessons no matter what. Nobody can get it all right. And you learn from those and you keep growing and doing things that, you know, ultimately scale the business and move the business. But I loved your suggestion about marketing because that was sort of my first love, was that kind of how we went to market. And, you know, all those things to me are very entrepreneurial because you get to decide what this all looks like, from the colors to the messaging to the, you know, the website, the videos. But I thought it was just interesting that you started there because, you know, some of my previous guests are really good at Craig Goldenfarb, Morse. You see them doing those things. And I think that taking that first step is really, you know, an incredible suggestion because it does change your mindset. But I wanted to ask you about marketing specifically because you mentioned it, and we know that how crucial that is if you really are looking to grow and scale your a personal injury law practice. Could you share 3 effective marketing strategies specifically tailored for personal injury law firms? Because I know, you know, digital marketing has completely changed the landscape for personal injury practices. I'm curious what your suggestions would be for that.
Yeah, so I'll start with anchoring it back to the five concepts from earlier. I talked about referral marketing. So let's get a little pragmatic on the referral marketing side first and foremost. So for referral marketing, the core conceit is let's build a list and then nurture it very consistently. So the things I think about there, like I coach everyone on a simple three-part plan, which is you're going to do two meetups every single week, coffee, lunch, Zoom, phone call. I don't care how it happens. I want you to talk with two people every single week. We'll get in the rhythm of one new and one returning person in your life, right? Second part of that plan is I want you to send a weekly email, which not monthly. It's got to be weekly. Open rates are better. Your unsubscribe rate is lower. There's just every possible positive effect doing a weekly email. And then I like to send something in the mail as well, a print newsletter. My own company, we send a free print newsletter to people on our list. And even when we have someone sign up with an email address, we'll go and hunt down your mailing address because I want that information as well. So I'm going to drive right into that referral marketing place first and foremost because it's so under your control. It's not an algorithm. It builds one of your greatest assets, which is your list. And having a powerful list gives you access to all sorts of opportunities, gives you the chance to drive people to your social media platforms, get more views on videos when you launch them, send traffic to your website to improve that health overall. You can prospect for new employees off your own list. You can do anything with a great list. So I'd send them there first. Then, and I'll tell you, this is the one that when I tell law firm owners this, I get the most mixed response on, Jason. Everyone has an opinion on this, which is local service ads. Everyone has some type of opinion on it, and most of it's negative, which is why I have my very simple rule. Try it every 6 months for about 30 days. If it doesn't work, turn it off. If it does work, congratulations. But if it doesn't work, you're going to come back 6 months later and try it again, because sometimes it's just a matter of who else is playing in local service ads in your community. How does Google feel about the algorithm? Have new competitors joined so there's enough people trying to participate that they actually listed in enough spaces? It's still a young tool overall to use, and I recommend testing it because if it clicks, it can really click. I have a coaching client who started doing local service ads, and he went from acquiring 6 clients per month to over 20 clients per month. He literally was so overwhelmed that he had to just he had to put a cap on it and start referring out tons of PI cases because of he couldn't hire fast enough. So
good problem. Man.
There's that power, right? Nice problem to have, isn't it? We all want that issue. Those are the problems we really love solving for. So investing in that space is absolutely worthwhile. And then as a final component, depending on the size that you are, I start people early on with more of a direct response advertising style where we have a very high measurement of return on investment. But if you're a PI firm that's in, say, the $3.5 million per year and up, and you have, say, a minimum of 3 attorneys in the firm, so you're able to disperse work, you take a solid volume of cases, you're not just looking for cases that are, say, $30,000 in fees each case or more. If you are looking for the ones that where your average is going to be between, say, $10,000 to $18,000 in fees to the firm, I do believe in adding in broadcast media such as television and radio, and I would be looking at a layer of it of OTT, over-the-top advertising for Hulu, Amazon Prime, and a lot of these other services that are starting to bake in commercials, and you can get some really good deals on some of those spaces and get great local advertising, which then you copy and paste those advertisements over on YouTube, and now we're creating a big omnipresent strategy that could be the leap between being a $5 million firm and a $15 million firm. So that last one is really for the bigger firms, but they need leveling up strategies as well.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit and ask you about leadership, because that's incredibly important in terms of building a company that is consistent with your values and the culture that you want to create. So what are some of the essential leadership qualities that a law firm owner should focus on to build and lead a high-performing team?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones, I saw Marco Brown talk about this recently on LinkedIn and really agree with him, which is there comes a point in your firm, usually as you get towards the $1 million mark in revenue, you have 3-4 team members and you're about to move towards 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 team members. It's this transition away from ever describing your law firm as a family. That's a huge, huge leadership gap right there. Is a lot of people say, oh, I want it to be like a family. You have a family. Like I personally work almost, well, I work 100% with people who have families. That's just, I have my two girls who I love and adore. I kind of joke that I'm a terrible coach for a bachelor because that's so not my lifestyle. And so I work best with people who are, you know, closely aligned, right? Working with people who have your similar values. And you have to understand that the people, and we talk about this being the transition between being the head of the family and becoming the captain of the ship. When you're the captain of the ship, your job is to select the destination, the mission that you are on. And you need crew members who do their jobs really well and who the other crew members can rely on doing their jobs really well. And in a family, you have someone who you don't necessarily like, but they still get to come around pretty much whenever they want because they're family. When you're captain of the ship, someone's not performing well, you have to drop them off at the next destination and find someone else to come on board. And that one issue right there, that transition, it's tough because that's where you feel like the capitalism start to kick in. It feels like I'm being cruel to my team members. You're not. You might have to make a tough decision for the one person who's not allowed to be on the crew anymore. But you've made a positive decision, a healthy decision for every other person on that team. It's amazing. I'm sure you've probably seen this firsthand, Jason. You've probably talked with firm owners who have gone through this. They fire that one person, and all of a sudden, a team member comes up to them the next day and says, thank you, we've sort of been waiting for this. And all of a sudden, morale improves, and they're more productive, and everything's going so much better. Have you ever had that type of experience?
Unfortunately, many times. You know, that idea of family versus team, you know, I always use team because team is about performing together in a complementary fashion. And the goal is to have a high performing team. If there are people that don't work well with other people or are not performing at the level they need to, it's just like any professional sports organization or any high performing organization, they're not going to allow that because what it does is it demoralizes the people that you need to perform. When they see someone not performing, whether it's in sales or marketing or in, you know, operations, wherever that person sits, that is a huge demotivator to all the people that are showing up when someone is not showing up for their teammates and is still collecting a paycheck.
I mean, you remember that show, The Weakest Link? Yeah. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. Like that's what you have to deal with. Cause as actually one of my earliest theater directors say, the team's only as strong, the chain's only as strong as its weakest link. And that's an accurate metaphor for building a team. And if you have a really, really weak link, it doesn't matter if everyone else is trying to hold on. This thing is going to break. And even worse, sort of as you were describing there, Jason, other people will see what is happening. And the most painful thing is you have a great, you know, several great team members. You have one person who is just destroying the culture. And you watch your other team members slowly start to play down to that level because they now understand what they can get away with. It goes to that saying of what you tolerate is what you will get. And if you tolerate bad performance, if you tolerate, you know, people who cause drama, I promise you, you will end up with all the drama you could possibly want in your law firm. But if you refuse to tolerate it, that will start to go away. But it takes time, right? It takes time making a lot of decisions. You're going to turn people over in your firm. Positions will see several people go through them before you as a leader realize what you need in the firm and what your firm really needs. And that's hard. But in the process, you're going to help a lot of people realize what they also want in a job for themselves. And they will start to refine what opportunities they're really looking for. And that's okay. It hurts because it feels like I've failed as a leader, because a leader wants to be able to lead pretty much anyone, right? You want to be able to take whatever troops you're given and rush into battle with them. But when it comes to running a business or a team or an army, you do need people who match what you're trying to do, who have the right attitude, aptitude, and then we can develop some of the skills. They might need to come in with certain skills though as well. That's part of building a great team. And then the next big leadership thing I would say is, and it's a quote that I have carried with me now for a long time, the leader is the lid. And if you are not thinking about the next level, if you are not expanding this business and generating opportunities, you are capping every single person in the firm. And the best people on your team will rise to that ceiling and find another place to go. If you want to keep your best people, keep creating opportunities for them. And never forget, you as the leader, you are the lid on those opportunities. If you can think big and act big, you will have a very big place for others to live out very big dreams for themselves as well. Because not everyone, by the way, is meant to be an entrepreneur. Not everyone's meant to start a business. Some really want to be an awesome employee in someone else's business and recognize this collective dream together. So grateful for those people. Please, every law firm owner, build a place where those folks want to stay, thrive, and recommend others to come on over.
So you just talked about something which I think is incredibly important, this idea of the leader being the lid. And I'm assuming that you're probably of a similar mindset to me, which is, you know, I really look for ways to grow personally and professionally. That group I was talking about that Dan Martell is part of, a big part of that is personal growth, but then also professional growth. Now I have to commit time to doing that. And, you know, that can be a challenge because of the demands of synergy and, you know, everything else that you have going on as a human being. But so specifically for trial lawyers who are leading their organizations, what do you suggest in terms of that balance of, you know, making sure they devote enough time to personal and professional growth, all the while managing the demands of personal injury practice? Because that can be a huge challenge. I know there's mastermind groups and there's different groups, you know, that ultimately can support that. And I do all those things, but it comes at a cost, right? There, then you have to have other people that can fill the gaps when you're spending time doing things that raise that lid somewhat.
So I'd start from the point of find what fits in your life right now and then take it up to an uncomfortable degree. So right now, if you think to yourself, like, I'm bootstrapping this thing, I have the budget to go get a few books that Jason and Charlie recommend, I'd say, cool, do that and go to an event. And buy a course and wake up early Saturday and Sunday morning and start going through that course for yourself, right? Just and it past your comfort zone. Because part of the development thing you mentioned it earlier, Jason, is that being uncomfortable side of things. So do something that is outside of your existing, you know, okay, cool, you're listening to this podcast right now. Clearly you're interested in doing something different with your life. If all you've been doing is listening to podcasts, now it's time to buy the books, which means it's probably time to buy the course. And soon enough, you're going to go to the event and then you're investing in a coach. You're working with a mastermind group. Maybe you're part of a community like Ryan McKean's Best Era as well. And you're digging into all these areas. I mean, I invest a significant percentage of what we make at Law Firm Alchemy into development for myself and for my team. It's been that way ever since back in it was either late 2010 or late 2011, when I wanted to become good at copywriting and a resource was recommended to me from AWAI, American Writer and Artist Institute. And they're actually still a great copywriting coaching community. But it was this copywriting program, their flagship program, and it was $500. And for me at the time, $500 was a lot of money. It was money I did not have, but I had the one thing that every American has access to: credit. And you better believe I put $500 down to buy that program, and it made me a better copywriter for doing so. I had already purchased books like The Ultimate Sales Letter by Dan Kennedy, but now it's time to really put my money where my mouth was. And so if you're serious about the personal development, invest in a level that scares you, because if it doesn't scare you, you can easily put it off to the side and say, eh, you know, what's $1,000 here or there? Eh, I don't care that I don't really use the community that much. No, you probably should have put $10,000 into a place, or $25,000 or $50,000 into coaching, community, mastermind. Do it at the level that scares you, because that will kick you in the butt to do something with it.
Good advice. And you know, there's a tipping point with that, I think, too. And you know, when you fully invest in that and you see ultimately what that gives you in terms of your own ability to raise the bar and seeing your team raise the bar as well, those are things that can be incredibly rewarding, but also help fuel growth and scalability of what you're building.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're not going and getting the development, then when you ask your team to go and do development, you know, it's a little bit, well, why should they take it seriously if you don't seem to be taking it seriously, right? It's the classic. And I actually remember in getting a theater degree, I took a class on lighting, and the professor in there literally made the statement, "Do as I say, not as I do." You're like, well, I mean, I guess at least he's honest about it, but it feels a little bit like you're hiding something from us, and that you've got the more efficient way of doing things, and we'd like to know that rather than whatever geese you've got us chasing. Your team's going to feel the same way. You know, you ask them to read a book, for example, and you're the person who never actually reads yourself. And by the way, they don't know all of your reading habits. But there's something metaphysical to all of this. Like, I'm not going to get too woo-woo about it, because I don't know. Like, I'm the type of person, when it comes to visualization, I recognize that that's the reticular activating system kicking in. So even then, your team can sniff it out a little bit. They can tell when it's disingenuous. And by the way, what type of culture do you think you're creating if you are being disingenuous in that way? You are inviting people who will come in and be disingenuous themselves. You're encouraging a culture of misinformation, essentially, in your practice. And we know that's not really what you want. I'm curious, Jason, for yourself, I mean, you know, since you're a student of all of this, like, have there been any books for yourself that have been particularly influential? I'm always looking to add to the book list.
I don't know if you've ever read any of Joey Coleman's books, Never Lose a Customer Again. And then he wrote a follow-up to that, Never Lose an Employee Again. Both those books to me were really important in terms of what I was looking to build here at Synergy, both in terms of customer experience and also my team's experience. So those two books are great books, I think, for any business owner. And I think lawyers especially, he's actually a lawyer. He calls himself a recovering lawyer. I've had him on the podcast a couple of times to talk about the applicability of his framework to law firms. I think those are two books that really any business owner would be well to read those.
You know, I always go right to Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah, you know, like, that's a classic. And the reason I like going to that one, Jason, is because it's one of those books that, you know, you encounter a lot of people who have read it, but did they really read it? You know, they checked that box, but when you ask them, like, oh, you know, which one is a principle that you really like? And they go, I like all 7 of them. Like, come on, give me a begin with the end in mind. Seek first to understand. Be proactive. And do you know what that really means? Right. That's always been one of the go-tos on development for me.
I wanted to ask you about something because it's incredibly important, I think, in the personal injury space and really in the practice of law, the idea of integrity and transparency. And we use that, you know, here at Synergy, because obviously we have to live and die by, you know, our integrity. And that's actually one of our core values, corporate values. But I'm curious, you know, in your opinion, how do law firm owners, because you talk to them, cultivate that kind of culture within their firms so that ultimately they get those good Google reviews and they have their clients' trust and their reputation remains intact?
Appreciate you, Jason, asking that, like, law firm owner specific question. Because when it comes to the law, We know that, unfortunately, people come into the space working with lawyers with a degree of suspicion, right? Because there's just been a lot of bad press. And I kind of joke that every time I'm in a social situation, I tell people that I work with lawyers, I'm sort of excited for the fact that I get to be an evangelist for this community to those folks and trying to turn opinions one person at a time. But if you know that that can be a suspicion, it means you have to do some extra work to overcome it. And the way to do that, you know, with transparency and integrity, I would say the real word here is patterns, and patterns lead to trust. So this is huge. If you tell someone that you are going to call them back tomorrow at 3 o'clock, please move heaven and earth to call them at 3 o'clock. If you tell folks that, you know, this is the attorney that they're going to be working with, and, you know, let's say it's a criminal defense firm, this is the attorney who's going to be at your next hearing. If you know 4 hours ahead of time that that is not going to be the attorney at the hearing after all, because they got called away to handle something else and you need to send someone different, you call that client in that moment and you say, this happens sometimes. Here's the good news. We have Jack. And Jack's a great attorney. He's looking over your file for the next 4 hours and will be just as prepared as Sally was going to be for it. And you let them know in that moment. Even better if ahead of time you say, hey, we want to let you know, chances are Sally's going to be the one at your hearings. That's the one that we're planning on. If something comes up, we already have someone lined up who will look over the file and handle the case for you, and you will see Jack there instead. That type of building and then living up to expectations, that type of intention, it's a powerful antidote to the concerns folks have. And so I would say that for a lot of attorneys, it's more making sure that you just honor the trust being put in you rather than being wildly demonstrative. It's that simple pattern that you continually do the thing that you say you are going to do. And when it doesn't go right, you'd never hide it. You just openly admit it. And actually, that ties into a leadership principle as well, and even a marketing principle, which is when you know that you're supposed to make the ask or deliver the information, you do it in the moment. You do it as fast as possible. Stop waiting to send the email 3 days later. Just pull that Band-Aid off right now. The person on the other side will always be grateful. And by the way, they're not going to hate you for it. Whatever it is, I promise you they're not going to hate you for it. It just, we're all so anxious all the time. Just do the darn thing and it will work out.
I actually meant to ask you this early on, but our chief revenue officer had met you and he told me to ask you about chess since you're an avid player. Is there any relevance to anything that we've talked about today in terms of management of law firms, growth and scaling of law firms that you've learned from being such an avid chess player?
Which we're just coming off of the Speed Chess Championships. The greatest of all time, Magnus Carlsen, reclaimed his title yet again with a barn burner against his rival Hans Niemann in the semifinals and completely crushing Alireza Ferrugia in the finals. I'm saying that because I know literally no one
will know that. I have no idea what you're talking
no
about.
One. Yeah, exactly. Right now, the Chess Olympiad is going on in Budapest, which has all of the nations sending teams to represent. So America actually has some really good chess players. Wesley So, Hakura Nakamura, Fabiano Caruana. We almost made it to the chess championship, but unfortunately not going to happen. But I actually do think that chess has a powerful, powerful metaphor, which is in chess, you have three phases to the game. You have openings, you have middle games, and you have the end game, right? It makes perfect sense right there. And chess is also talked about positional chess and tactical chess. A lot of people want to be these really clever tacticians. They want to know all these fancy little moves that you can toss in there. And I see that in marketing, leadership, you know, the type of people who always have a new specialized question that they're using in leadership, or they're always testing out this random headline that they heard suggested by one person that apparently is going to cure all of their ills. And maybe it is a really good headline, and maybe it is a really good question to ask. But that's, tactics make the most sense in the middle game. The reason most people don't become proficient chess players is because they don't study the openings. And so they never make it to a real middle game. So they could execute one cool, clever maneuver at the beginning, but the other person across the table who has sound fundamentals and studies the openings, which are, there are simply better openings than others, especially for newer chess players. And when you want to become good in business, it's not about the clever stuff. It's about doing the core of it. You do need to monitor your metrics. You do need to put a lead generation system in place. You do need to have more efficient operations that will improve your profit margins. A lot of this stuff is boring. The openings are not super thrilling. But if you don't learn that, you will get crushed time after time after time, and it becomes utterly demoralizing. And it's why a lot of people never really get into chess in the first place.
So a couple questions and I'll let you go before we wrap up. So you also have a podcast that you host and it's law related. I'm curious if there's one or two things, key things that you've learned from your guests on They Don't Teach This in Law School podcast.
I think the most important thing is the diversity of perspectives and that there are many ways to do it right. This is the exciting thing. Like, just like there are multiple openings in chess that are very, very effective. And it's really about finding the ones that work best for you, that seem to play complementary to the rhythms and patterns of your own brain and the way that you look at the board. The same thing is true of building the business. There are lots of great ways to build a great law firm or any other business. It's spending some time learning from those types of folks, whether it's on my podcast or this podcast you're listening to right now, learning from Jason and his guests, listening to those folks and understanding it's okay for you to hear someone's business model and go, I don't think that one is right for me. That may very well be the case. On the other hand, if you hear something and go, oh, that really clicks with me, you know, take action with that. That's the other commonality among my most successful guests is they hear an idea and it's not enough for it to be an idea for them. They hear it and go, oh, this fits interestingly within my business modus operandi. I'm going to try something with this and see how well it clicks. And great, then it starts to click. I'm going to go all in on this. And they take action. So it's being open to the different perspectives, understanding there's no one way to do this thing. And then when that synapse fires of this is interesting, go and take action on it to start validating it for yourself.
So last question, and this is completely open-ended. I'm giving you an opportunity to talk about whatever you want as you close us out. Since the podcast is Trial Lawyer View, the question is, what is your view as a law firm growth coach and expert?
So much of life comes down to knowing yourself. And that word that I've used a few times, identity. And the reason I think I know it's so important is the quick and dirty version is as a theater major and as a kid who moved around a whole bunch, my father was FBI. We moved around many times when I was young. I was always trying to figure out my identity because we're talking about Colorado, Maryland, Michigan, Texas, Virginia. Those are very different cultures from one another. If I'd stayed in Texas, I'd probably be, you know, a football player. Moving to Virginia, having that last move that started to mess with like, who am I, led me towards theater. But all of those experiences together helped me realize I was always searching for what is my identity. And over time, getting comfortable with who I am, the energetic side of me that some people look at and go, oh, that's just too much, which in the past I might have tamped down. That's an example of finding my identity and going, you know what? I see the flaws in it, but I love it because it's who I am. For every law firm owner out there, lawyer, human being listening to this, spending time, you know, that you hear the phrase being comfortable in your own skin. Truly, that idea of finding a way to be comfortable in your own skin, own who you are, and know that it's both a blessing and a curse. It is, but that's okay. That is 100% A-okay. When you invest that time in knowing yourself, it makes life so much easier to go through because you stop caring so much about what other people think and you get to focus on doing what is right for you and the people that you love most.
Wonderful advice to close us out. I've done a lot of work looking inward to really understand what I'm all about and what excites me and what challenges me and what scares me and doing all those things. So it's a great Great point. And by the way, I meant to mention this. My daughters are older now, but I was for a long time identifying myself as a girl soccer dad, because I had two that played club soccer all the way through high school soccer. And it was a really fun time. So you've got a lot to look forward to in that regard, based on what you told me about your daughter.
I'm looking forward to all the challenges, the late nights, the infinite number of practices, the games that are, why are they 2 hours and 45 minutes away? But I guess we got to go to them. You know, just investing in all of it. Because I'll tell you something cool, Jason. She, unprompted at one point, said, I want to be a world champion. And I said, oh, that's thrilling. Here's the deal I'll make with you. I'm going to keep asking you over and over again, do you still want to be a world champion? As long as you tell me yes and you put in the work, I'll make the sacrifices with you to get you to the camps, to get you to the games, to whatever it is that you need to do to become a world champion, as long as it's a path you're still looking to pursue.
It's the best thing you can do for your kids, ultimately, is give them those opportunities and support them along the way, right? That's one of the key things about being a parent, is being there for them. So any of our listeners would like to get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about Law Firm Alchemy and what you can do for their practices. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Probably the best thing to do is go directly to lawfirmalchemy.com. We always have something available that we're giving away free to firm owners. You know, our referral marketing playbook, 5 highest ROI marketing strategies for law firms. Go there and pick up something that speaks to you. That is absolutely the best place to start. And then from there, we'll see how we jive together. And if there's a cool way for us to explode the growth of your practice and live mutually excellent lives while doing so.
Great. We'll include links to the website in the show notes for today's episode. Charlie, thanks for joining me on Trial Lawyer View, and we'll see everybody on the next episode.
Thank you, Jason.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.